This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. As more police departments around the United States continue to review and revamp policies and crack down on what's deemed abuse by officers in the wake of the death of George Floyd and subsequent protest, the Atlanta officer who fatally shot Rashard Brooks in the back after the fleeing man pointed a stun gun in his direction has been charged with felony murder and 10 other crimes. Fulton County District Attorney Paul Howard made the announcement about Garrett Rolfe during a news conference Wednesday. Howard said Rolfe kicked Brooks while he lay on the ground and that the officer with him stood on Brooks' shoulder as he struggled for life Friday. Rolfe has been already fired after he fatally shot the 27-year-old Brooks. The other officer, Devin Bronson, has been charged with aggravated assault and other crimes. A dramatic shift has taken place in the nation's opinions on policing and race as a new poll finds that Americans today, more than 5 years ago, believe police brutality is a very serious problem that too often goes undisciplined and unequally targets Black Americans. The poll by the Associated Press Newark Center for Public Affairs research finds that about half of American adults now say police violence against the public is a very or extremely serious problem. Only about 3 in 10 said the same in July of 2015. Those who say it is not a serious problem has declined from a third in 2015 to about 2 in 10 today. More than 448,000 people have died globally from COVID-19. More than 117,000 in the United States. Worldwide, the number of confirmed infections is well above 8.3 million, and it exceeds 2.1 million in the United States. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Latin America continues to see an explosion in COVID-19 cases. Brazil is the epicenter, and it has the second highest number of deaths and infections globally. China has canceled flights and suspended reopenings when the coronavirus flared in the capital of Beijing. But when cases rising in some U.S. states, officials have balked at even requiring face masks. A political and cultural debate has emerged as officials struggle to balance demands for constitutional rights and personal freedom against warnings from doctors of deadly consequences. Arizona's governor has encouraged people to use masks, but has not worn one during news conferences and rebuffed calls to require them. Cases are surging there, and the state's leading hospital system says it is almost running out of beds. A genetic analysis of COVID-19 patients suggests that blood type might influence whether someone develops severe disease. Scientists who compared the genes of thousands of patients in Europe found that those who had type A blood were more likely to have severe disease, while those with type O were less likely. Wednesday's report in the New England Journal of Medicine does not prove a blood type connection, but it does confirm a previous report from China of such a link. The experts say more study is needed in different groups of patients to see if the findings actually hold up. U.S. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is requiring that House members wear masks when attending committee hearings. The edict comes amid spiking COVID-19 caseloads in many states. In the recent infection by a House Republican who had been seen on the House floor recently without wearing a mask. Results have been mixed, though, as the House Judiciary Committee and panel conducted a session on a policing bill. Republican Jim Jordan of Ohio declined to wear a mask for much of that session, and California Republican Tom McClintock scrapped with Chairman Gerald Nadler, who declared he would not call upon lawmakers who were failing to wear the mask. U.S. President Donald Trump has now signed legislation that seeks to punish China for its crackdown on Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities. This move comes as a new book by the former National Security Advisor John Bolton says that Mr. Trump expressed support for the brutal campaign in a private conversation with China's president. The bill includes sanctions on Chinese officials involved in the mass surveillance and detention of Uyghurs and others. It does represent the most significant action to date by any country to punish China for a crackdown in which more than 1 million people have been detained in camps under harsh conditions. Find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi's president-elect will be sworn in today to complete the late President Nkurunziza's term.
There is hope that he will be able to be opening up a little bit the country, but at the same time, there is some hesitation because he will have to still deal with the vested interests of other powerful generals.
Zimbabwe nurses go on strike over salary cut. Malawi lawyers took to the streets on Wednesday in defense of judicial independence. Teenage pregnancy is on the rise in Kenya during the COVID-19 pandemic. The UN Human Rights Council debates alleged racism in the United States at the request of Africa. And ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda comments on denial of visa to enter the United States.
We express profound regret at the announcement of further threats and coercive actions, including financial measures against the court and its officials that were made by the government of the United States.
And an American pastor pleads guilty to sex crimes in Kenya. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi's president-elect Evariste Ndayishimiye will be sworn in today, Thursday, to complete the late President Pierre Nkurunziza's term. Nkurunziza passed away suddenly on June 8 at age 55. Elected May 20 this year, Ndayishimiye was supposed to begin his own seven-year term August 20, but Burundi's constitutional court ruled that he should be sworn in to complete Nkurunziza's term. His ascendancy to the presidency comes as Burundi has had domestic and international challenges under the late Nkurunziza. So, what kind of leader would Ndayishimiye be? Lidewide Beckmans is assistant professor of African studies at Leiden University in the Netherlands.
He's a general, General Evariste Ndayishimiye, with the nickname General Neva. He is one of the persons that has been in the inner circle, you can say, of the late President Nkurunziza.
The late President Pierre Nkurunziza was Burundi's longest-serving president since independence. The key question people are asking is, can Ndayishimiye step out of the Nkurunziza shadow, or is he likely to continue the late President Pierre Nkurunziza's policies?
Until last week, I can say there was a lot of concern about whether he would be able to step out of his shadow, especially because Nkurunziza would be taking a new role within the government as the superior leader of patriotism, I think it is in English, of the country. So behind the scenes, the idea was that Nkurunziza would probably still try to have a lot of influence on the new president would do. But given his recent death, there is more hope now that he will be able to step out of the shadow of late president. That said, however, he was appointed the next candidate for the presidential elections for the CNDD-FDD political party. It was a compromise between the different party stalwarts, you can say, and in that sense, while he will be in power and he is very powerful, he will still have to deal with all the internal power struggles within the party and have to give account also to the other powerful generals within the party. So the expectation is that he will not be entirely free.
During the late Pierre Nkurunziza's administration, international relations went sour, particularly with the European Union and just recently last year with the International Criminal Court. What do you think will likely be the new Burundian leader's foreign policy?
I think there's a lot of hope for him to be able to open up the country a little bit more. The country, indeed, since especially 2015, has faced a political crisis, increasing isolation and also increasing levels of poverty. The country was already extremely poor. So there is hope that he will be able to be opening up a little bit the country. But at the same time, there is some hesitation because he will have to still deal with the vested interests of other powerful generals. So the question will remain whether he will really be able to have a different policy in that sense.
Lidewide Beckmans is assistant professor of African studies at Leiden University in the Netherlands. Lawyers in Malawi Wednesday took to the streets in major cities against what they call government interference in the judiciary for nullifying last May's election. The lawyers are protesting the government's attempt to force the country's chief justice to take leave pending his retirement. And just ahead of the court-mandated June 23 election rerun, Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The lawyers who were in gowns and wigs carried placards and sang songs about their independence from the executive arm of the government. The demonstrations were in reaction to the government's decision to force the country's Chief Justice, Andrew Nyirenda, to go on leave pending his retirement. John Suzibanda is the former president of the Malawi Law Society. He told VOA the lawyers are concerned about constant attacks coming from the executive arm on the judiciary.
We're calling the chief justice and judges' names, calling them compromised and all manner of things. And this is coming from no less person than the state president himself. We've come here to tell the executive that they should keep their hands off.
In a statement last week, the government said the chief justice has accumulated more than 500 leave days, which would take him to his retirement time. Banda says the move is against the separation of powers, one of the key pillars of the country's constitutional democracy, which puts the three arms of government, legislature, executive, and judiciary independent.
The issue of leave days is not for the executive to deal with. They are within the judiciary people who deal with these things. There is no reason why the secretary of the cabinet should be coming on these grounds and start pointing at judicial officer to say, you go home on leave. And then where's the independence?
The relationship between the judiciary and President Peter Mutharika soured after the courts nullified last year's elections, in which Mutharika won a second term. At a political rally Wednesday, President Mutharika made a fresh accusation against the judiciary for conniving with opposition parties to topple his government. Rafiki Hajat is the executive director of the Institute for Policy Interaction think tank. He supports the lawyer's concerns.
And the executive has got to retract that statement and restore the status quo to what it was before this whole fiasco. Because if we accept actions like this without objection, we are accepting dictatorship.
The Commonwealth Magistrates and Judges Association, the Commonwealth Legal Association, the Commonwealth Lawyers Association, and Judges for Judges also have issued a statement asking Malawi's executive arm of the government to desist from interfering in the affairs of the judiciary. But the government is refusing to budge, saying this is not the first time that chief justices have gone on leave pending retirement after accumulating more leave days. In a statement Tuesday, government spokesperson Mark Bodoman said the Mutharika government sees nothing wrong in asking the incumbent chief justice to go on leave until his retirement. However, Malawi's High Court has in the meantime granted two injunctions against the government's decision. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Nurses in Zimbabwe went on strike on Wednesday after the government cut their salaries without giving a reason. Doctors have threatened to join the strike, saying they cannot cope with the workload at a time when cases of COVID-19, now almost 400 in Zimbabwe, are on the rise. Public health experts say President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government must quickly resolve the conflict or risk seeing a further spread of the virus. Columbus Mavunga has the story from Harare.
Those are nurses outside the health services body chanting, "We are tired of receiving the paltry salary, which does not take us far. We want to be paid in US dollars, which you, the senior government officials, receive at times." Enoch Dongo is the head of Zimbabwe Nurses Association and was among the protesters who defied the country's COVID-19 lockdown regulations, which forbid demonstrations.
"We are suffering.
Yes. Frontline
the
people.
Salaries that we received this month, it's pathetic. It's an insult.
Yes.
We were also taken by surprise at the time where we were expecting government to increase our salaries or giving us a stable currency that we can use, they have cut that we were earning. What we want is money. So that we can feed our families. Because what we want is a sustainable salary that can take us through each and every month.
Most government workers in Zimbabwe now earn less than $50 a month because of the country's currency is losing value. Asked for comment on Wednesday, Obadiah Moyo, Zimbabwe's health minister, said he would only talk to the media after talking to the health workers. Ernest Manyau, the head of Zimbabwe's biggest hospital, appealed in vain to the nurses to call off the strike while officials find out why salaries were cut.
It doesn't resolve the issues. Let's take the issues to our principals. They are working on it. They are seized with the matter.
Dr. Nyika Mahachi is the president of Zimbabwe College of Public Health Physicians. He says the nurses' strike must be resolved quickly before winter makes public health even worse.
The country is not only faced with the rising number of COVID-19 cases, but also at the same time, we have existing burden of HIV, TB, malaria, maternal mortality that the country needs to continue to respond to.
The government has not explained why the nurses' salaries were cut, but it could be a simple issue of money. Zimbabwe's government has been cash-strapped for years amid an economy that has struggled since the turn of the century. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 18. The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda, says she will not be swayed from her mission of prosecuting international war crimes. This after U.S. President Donald Trump last year authorized sanctions against the court, which is probing suspected war crimes and crimes against humanity by U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Bensouda, originally from The Gambia, tells VOA in her first interview since President Trump's remarks that the attacks constitute an unacceptable attempt to interfere with the rule of law and the work of the court.
Let me start by saying that I stand by the statement that was issued by the court. We express profound regret at the announcement of further threats and coercive actions, including financial measures against the court and its officials that were made by the government of the United States. These attacks constitute an escalation and an unacceptable attempt to interfere with the rule of law and the court's judicial proceedings. They are announced with the declared aim of influencing the actions of ICC officials in the context of the court's independent and objective investigations and impartial judicial proceedings. And an attack on the ICC also represents an attack against the interests of victims of atrocity crimes, for many of whom the ICC represents the last hope for justice. And it is important to note that under the Rome Statute, the jurisdiction of the ICC complements national jurisdictions. National authorities have the primary responsibility for investigating and prosecuting Rome Statute crimes. And I just want to highlight this, that if U.S. courts have exercised or are exercising jurisdiction over cases identified by the office, and if those proceedings are genuine, then the ICC cannot prosecute U.S. nationals for these alleged crimes. The visa restrictions, the threats, and the other measures that are announced by the U.S., I see as naked attempts to interfere with the court's judicial and prosecutorial independence to meet political objectives. And we regret the aggressive position that has been taken by the U.S. government, not least given the country's long-standing contribution to the field of international criminal justice. And we hope that this path will be reconsidered.
You mentioned that visa restrictions that you've received, you've been specifically denied from entering to the U.S. to proceed with the process that you've started. Have you taken any action? And what happens when a country or the U.S. does not cooperate with the ICC, where do you go?
Well, first and foremost, with respect to the visa restriction, this was since, I believe, at the beginning of last year when the visa was revoked. In fact, I have traveled to the U.S. since then, at least on a few occasions, in connection with my report to the UN Security Council, because that visa, the restriction, does not extend to UN business. Therefore, when I need to go to the U.S., like, for instance, briefing to the UN Security Council, I will be granted visa, and I have been granted visa in the past.
Fatou Bensouda, originally from the Gambia, is prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. She was speaking with viewers Salim Solomon. Participants of a debate on systemic racism at the UN Human Rights Council have called for an independent investigation into the death of African-American George Floyd while in police custody. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Council meeting began with a moment of silence for all the victims of racial injustice. In opening Wednesday's debate, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed said merely condemning expressions and acts of racism was not enough to alleviate generations of suffering resulting from racial injustice. Speaking by teleconference from New York, she said the debate was taking place as marches for racial justice and equality take place around the world.
The most recent trigger for these protests was the killing of George Floyd in an appalling act of police brutality. But the violence spans history and borders alike across the globe. Today, people are saying loudly and movingly, enough. The United Nations has a duty to respond to the anguish that has been felt by so many for so long.
In Geneva, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet deplored the death of George Floyd in what she called an act of gratuitous brutality. She said Floyd's death while in police custody in the U.S. city of Minneapolis last month has come to symbolize the systemic racism that harms millions of people of African descent.
He has brought to a head the outrage of people who feel they are neither adequately served nor adequately heard by their governments. It has brought to their feet millions of allies, people who are now beginning to acknowledge the reality of systemic discrimination suffered by others, and to join their demand that every person in their countries be treated with equality, fairness, and respect.
The brother of George Floyd gave an emotional address to the council by teleconference from his home in the U.S. city of Houston, Texas. Philonis Floyd described his family's anguish while watching the last moments of his brother's life.
You and the United Nations are your brothers and sisters' keepers in America, and you have the power to help us get justice for my brother George Floyd. I'm asking you to help him. I'm asking you to help me. I'm asking you to help us, black people in America.
In advance of the debate, U.S. Ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Andrew Bremberg, issued a statement affirming Washington's commitment to addressing racial discrimination and injustices stemming from that. In alluding to the death of George Floyd, he said U.S. President Donald Trump condemned the brutal actions of the police involved and was implementing police reforms. He cited the steps as an example of government transparency and responsiveness in holding violators accountable for their actions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pregnancy among teenage students in Kenya is on the rise as the country battles the COVID-19 pandemic. According to a Kenya Health Information System survey, at least 4,000 school-going teenagers in Machakos County of eastern Kenya are pregnant. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the Ministry of Education has blamed some parents for neglecting their children during the pandemic.
More than 200 school-going girls below the age of 19 years are sexually assaulted and impregnated weekly in Machakos County of Eastern Kenya. This is according to Machakos County Children's Office that estimates at least 4,000 teenagers have been impregnated for the last 5 months. Machakos County Children Officer Salome Mudama said that the cases have been on the rise due to negligence of children by parents, especially at this time when most parents have left their children with grandparents. In Machakos County, 4,000 girls have been impregnated during the COVID-19 pandemic. And that is a big number, given that this happened in a span of only 5 months. Girls below the age of 19 are pregnant, and it has been confirmed by our hospitals. Earlier, the National Council of Population and Development revealed that 1 in 5 girls aged between 15 and 19 is either pregnant or has already given birth. The young girls are said to be lured into sex by adults who promise to buy them sanitary towels, as reports indicate that most of the girls cannot afford the towels. Machakos Rescue Center Administrator Damaris Kasula wants the government to offer support to girls they have rescued from sexual assaults.
The challenge that we are facing currently as an institution, children are contained within the institution. They have nowhere to go because they are not going to school. So it has become a challenge for children, and they actually need a lot of psychosocial support.
Kenya law prohibits adults from engaging in sex with minors with jail terms ranging from 15 years or life imprisonment to those found guilty of the offense. Education Cabinet Secretary George Magoha has blamed parents for not taking care of teenagers at this time of the pandemic.
This ministry has noted some parents, guardians and caregivers are not providing sufficient care of their children while at home. And shame, a very big shame on the parents. If you have no time to look after your child, then perhaps you have no business creating a child.
According to the report by the National Council of Population and Development, most teenage pregnancies are fueled by rape, defilement, poverty, early marriages, peer influence, drug abuse, and lack of youth-friendly health services. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
An American Christian missionary, Gregory Dow, pleaded guilty this week to sex crimes in Kenya. Dow admitted to 4 counts of illicit sexual conduct with minors at an orphanage he founded in 2008. The girls were ages 11 to 13. The conviction of Dow represents just one example of a larger systemic problem, said Cici Matikere, global lead on Equality Now's and Sex Trafficking Division. She spoke with Ricky Stryak about changes that need to be made to protect girls and women.
The importance is really that it's reflecting numerous other cases that are the same. Just a few months ago, there was a prominent case in Uganda of a German national who had traveled to Uganda and set up a children's home, supposedly to support girls that had experienced sexual exploitation. But he was also being charged with 18 counts of trafficking, of indecent sexual abuse of children, and even operating an illegal home. So what we see really are, you know, foreign nationals, mainly coming from Western countries, who are masquerading as champions of children's rights and take advantage really of some of the structural weaknesses in local protection, child protection systems. So when you have, you know, orphanages that are set up without due process of law, without adequate supervision, they are also taking advantage sometimes as well of weak law enforcement systems and judicial processes that are very slow. And then, you know, just take advantage of those structural weaknesses to abuse with impunity.
What kind of changes are people like yourself from Equality Now, other groups in Kenya fighting for?
What we are looking to see really is more comprehensive laws and policies that support children, and also laws and policies that are moving with the current reality of how sexual exploitation is occurring. So we know that sex tourism is a global problem, which is what the Gregory Dow case shows, and, you know, many others within the African context, and really requires that laws are in place both within the countries where the girls are exploited, but also in countries where the perpetrators are coming from. So in this case, it was, you know, really good that the American system has a law that follows their citizens when they exploit children abroad. But within Kenya, for instance, there is a sex tourism provision in their Sexual Offences Act, but I think it needs to be much more stronger and the sentencing much more clearer.
That was Sisi Matekeri, the global lead on Equality Now's and Sex Trafficking Division. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. And that's it for this Thursday, June 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a very good day.